Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways you probably haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Questlove, and Cate Blanchett. In recent weeks, I talked to actor Dan Levy, director Ava DuVernay, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you needing a safe space to learn how you can get your mind right? Tune into Imani State of Mind, a weekly podcast hosted by psychiatrist and TV personality Dr. Imani Walker and co-host comedian Meg Scoop Thomas. Two smart, successful women and mothers sharing their personal and professional experiences to help normalize conversations around mental health. This is not your average mental health show. Each week, they break down what's happening in news, pop culture, and their very own experiences managing mental health. Together, you will laugh, keep it real, and create a safe space where everyone can get help with their issues. Nothing is off the table. Dr. Imani Walker and Meg Scoop Thomas discuss everything from relationships with yourself, with your spouse, and your parents to the realities of postpartum depression and anxiety. Do not forget to take a deep breath. Find your calm and get into Imani's State of Mind with new episodes dropping every Friday wherever you get your podcasts. The first vote-by-mail ballots are hitting people's mailboxes, and the earliest in-person early voting starts this week. Do you know how you're voting? If your answer is, it's September, I haven't thought about it. Am I going to go to my Halloween parties dressed as Mando? Am I going to go as a character from Legally Blonde? I haven't decided yet. Get off my back. This is the week to get your shit together on both counts, both for voting and for your Halloween costume. Voter suppression efforts have ramped up following the 2020 election, making it even more critical to ensure that every American has access to the ballot box. At Vote Save America, you can find the most up-to-date information on what you need to make sure your vote is counted in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Give Puerto Rico the statehood as well. Use our ballot ready tool to request your ballot. Find out how you can return it or get a reminder for when in-person early voting locations become available in your state. To win in November, it's going to take every single one of us making our plan to vote, getting involved, and reminding everyone we know to do the same. Once you've made your plan to vote, visit votesaveamerica.com/everylastvote to find out what you can do next, including donating to the Every Last Vote Fund to directly support the work of community organizations, organizers, and volunteers in states that are actively working to battle disenfranchisement in communities of color, including in Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and more. Warning, this podcast contains spoilers for She-Hulk Episode 6 and/or Episodes 1 through 3. We're releasing two episodes this week, so be sure to check out both for our full conversation. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion, and welcome to X-Ray Vision, the crooked podcast where we're diving deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture. On episode 2 this week, the episode you're listening to, we are talking to She-Hulk head writer Jessica Gao, and we will be discussing She-Hulk episode 6, which is a crazy, crazy... It just goes crazy. The episode goes crazy, and we will be discussing the latest entry in Star Wars television, Andor. Episodes 1 through 3 are out now on Disney Plus. So we'll be talking about that in a more general way to give you all time to digest the episodes, and we'll be going on a deeper dive in weeks to come. And of course, joining us today is Rosie Knight.
It's me. I'm here. Yes. Let's She-Hulk. We made it. We're on both episodes.
Yes. As always, everyone, check the show notes for the timestamps if you want to jump around and listen to the things that you want to listen to. Let's go back into the courtroom or the wedding hall, whatever the case may be, and talk about She-Hulk episode 6. Episode 6, Just Jen, written by Kara Brown, directed by Anu Valia. Lots to get into. Quick recap. Jen has to go to a wedding where she discovers that her arch rival, Her arch foe, Titania, is also a wedding guest. And is this some sort of part of this, some sort of plot for Titania to defeat Jen publicly in front of everyone? And then back at the law firm, Mallory and Nikki are dealing with the case of a gentleman who goes by the name of Mr. Immortal.
Dun, dun, dun!
Who cannot die because, you know, according to the comics, he's a flat-out mutant. And he has been using this power to not die to defraud various romantic partners and business partners by, quote-unquote, faking his death. Lots to get into, so let's just get into it. Fun episode once again.
This is just such a fun show, and I feel like I'm really impressed by how much fun they have digging into the weirder parts of Marvel. Like, obviously, Mr. Immortal, that's a big deal. So technically, he is, everyone in the Marvel universe sees him as a mutant. And technically, he is a mutant, but the thing that's really interesting is he is the only member of the evolutionary race known as the Homo Supreme. So he's like one above a mutant, but he is, for all extents and purposes, and is presents as Homo Superior, which is a mutant. So yeah, that's just like huge to have him here and also just use it in such an absolutely hilarious She-Hulk way.
Yes.
Where it's like, this guy has been defrauding people he loves because he can't have confrontation by just killing himself. It's like really bleak, but also very hilarious and very comic booky. And he is like, this is an extremely big episode in a lot of ways because it shows us not only that the creative team here, obviously absolutely hilarious, but also
this
like,
is the most comic book nerdy
he talks about digging in the stacks for these references. He talks about when he's there, he's talking about how he's got a lot of money, right? And part of how he got a lot of money is because ex-wife left him a bunch of gold.
Baroness
Cromwell, a.k.a. Baroness Blood. So this is just like, they were just like, yeah, go for it. They were like, Jessica, tell us, do it up.
Tell us who Baroness Blood is, and then let's dive into the really actually quite funny backstory of who Mr. Immortal is, at least in the comics.
Yeah, so Baroness Blood is like a really weird... creepy character who was first introduced hilariously in everyone's favorite comic, Union Jack number one. So she's actually from 1998, which isn't obviously that far away, but she's part of now, like most well known as a part of the Legion of the Unliving, which is like a group of vampires who were brought together by Dracula. So you can basically say, like, we've had a Johnny Blaze joke in this season. Yep. We're now getting into the realm where vampires probably exist. They're now just
also,
like,
and mutants are just mutants walking
are just
around
casually. Not only that, but as we guessed, so I'm taking this as a we were right.
Yeah,
we said post Miss Marvel, what they were going to do was just introduce random mutants here and there. They're going to say, here's a mutant, here's someone who's been living with these crazy powers, and we're just going to build them into the fabric of the world. And that's exactly what they're doing with Mr. Immortal and with the way that they're just casually kind of dropping in these things. I mean, Baroness Blood is like a supernatural, superpowered vampire. Makes sense that she would have married an immortal. I mean, that's a hookup that works. But basically, you can now say that vampires 100% do exist in the MCU.
Let me ask you this. My friend, comic book critic and sports writer Matt Turrell DM'd me, and he was like, hey, I think you and Rosie were talking about why does Atlantis come to the fore? I think they're going to do, when they introduce mutants, I think it's going to be similar to Atlantis, Secret Society, Krakoa era, and they're all there, and they reveal themselves, and then it's a question of how they, then become part of the wider society, if that's indeed what they decide to do. I kind of agree that I think Krakoa is going to be around, but here is what the appearance of Mr. Immortal suggests, that... Because if Krakoa is a thing, then Mr. Immortal should be on the island. Like, why are you...
Unless he's just like Nah.
He rejected the gift of Krakoa.
Because he's already immortal, so he doesn't need the Krakoan gift.
Here is the other thing that I think, and it kind of dovetails with Mr. Immortal. I do think that Krakoa exists, but I also think like Warren Worthington and others in a way that would seem insidious to the wider society have infiltrated human culture, have not revealed themselves to be mutants, but are around and are doing things, and are some of them are power brokers in human society. And I think that Mr. Immortal maybe points the way at that. Mutants being around, but have been kind of keeping it quiet for most of human history until recently, when it's like, oh, powered people are around. Maybe I can start being more obvious with the things that I'm doing.
No, Mr. Immortal makes a lot of sense in that context also, because he's essentially living by what I like to call like Twilight rules, where he's basically, because he's been alive for like a million years and he can never die, he's just immensely rich. So in its own way, especially in America and in like capitalism kind of culture, you have infiltrated the highest parts of society just simply by being incredibly wealthy. So that's exactly that kind of thing. And also, as we know, if GLKNH didn't exist, these women and Sebastian probably would never have actually known that he was immortal and hadn't actually died. And if they had have seen the video that we will get to, the Intelligentsia video, they wouldn't have had a way to get recompense. So I think that introducing this superhero law firm is a really good way of seeding exactly what you're talking about, where suddenly everyone's like, okay, wait a minute. I had a weird experience with this person, or that thing that I saw that one time.
Was that it?
Like that one time that I randomly don't remember something that happened when I got like Men in Black, and then suddenly my memory's wiped. Like, oh, they said that was like retrograde amnesia, but maybe that was actually like a mutant with mind control powers. So this is kind of huge in that way, as well as just being very fun.
Yeah, because that paranoia is a thing that we see a lot in X-Men comics, where parents are like, "Oh my God, I think my child might be a mutant. I think my coworker might be," and it creates this feeling of real fear in the general population. I want to note that it's remarkable to me that one, we got Mr. Immortal, and he's just presented just as himself with his powers, and no one at all has been like, where did he get these? We are past the point in the MCU where did they get the powers is really a question. They're just accepting that this guy can do this, and no one has thought to ask, well, how is he doing this?
That's my favorite thing about where we are now. It's almost like with that brilliant moment at the end of Ms. Marvel that we all loved so much, which was, you know, it's a mutation, that has basically opened the doors now for us as the viewers to just say, oh, well, they might be a mutant, or, oh, everyone has powers now. And it is giving a lot of leeway for the shows to just say, hey, superheroes exist. You know you've been in this world for 25 movies. Now it's just happening. But yeah, I did find it, especially a power like being immortal.
Yeah,
that
he's
is
not
a pretty intense power to have. And nobody...
He's not an Asgardian elf.
Nope.
He's not a former super soldier. He was not, subject to a radioactive accident. He's just running around with these very intense
can't
powers.
Die.
Nobody's talking about
Mickey
it.
Mickey and Mallory are just like, so you can die, you can't die.
Yeah, you
like,
can't
do
die.
Die.
You can't
like, which one? Like, you know... It's a very interesting time to be in the MCU.
It's great.
Yeah.
Okay. So much in that last kind of stinger scene where, you know, Jen is having, you know, the kind of the plate of fries at the end of the wedding after the big fight with Titania, kind of bonding with this guy who seems, pretty accepting and certainly maybe attracted to Jen, and they're sharing this plate of fries. And then we zoom out and it's clear that somebody is keeping track of Jen. We go to a futuristic lab where there is a screen where we see someone named Hulk King capitalized in a very interesting way, certainly in a way that would lead us to speculate about Hulkling. Hulkling, is that what that means? Saying, okay, where are we with Jen? We should note that this is exactly how Mr. Blue communicated with Mr. Green in the Incredible Hulk movie, mm-hmm. starring Ed Norton. And then, we see the bent needle that the Wrecking Crew attempted to stab Jen with.
Yeah.
And then we see another needle being snapped onto a new syringe. And it's early, but I'm going to call we were right on this, the adamantium needle.
Because I think
the
so
sound
too.
Effect, the sound effect, listen, it might be vibranium, but the sound, it was so distinct, and it led me to one, in the comics, the only thing that can penetrate the Hulk's skin is an adamantium needle.
Yes.
We've seen it numerous times in the comics. And two, the sound it makes is very much like
it's evocative.
It's evocative of Wolverine's claw.
Also, I would just say we were right. We can do a two-part we were right. One, I also agree. I think it has to be adamantium needle. They're just throwing mutants around now. I don't see any issue. Yeah, yeah. We've had multiple Wolverine Easter eggs at this point with stuff in Madripoor. But also as well, we were right. We knew they would make a new needle that would be made of some kind of super strong metal, be it adamantium or vibranium. So I would say we can take a we were right. And also if it's an adamantium needle, obviously that's so exciting because most people who are listening, I think, will probably know adamantium is the metal that covers Wolverine's bones and his claws in the X-Men comics and it plays a large part in the X-Men movies. So again, we're moving towards that mutant space.
Okay, so let's talk about two things here in that scene. One, Hulk King, who is he?
Okay.
Who is he or her? Who are they?
So I think that you're very right that they want it, again, if we're talking about evocative stuff, I think they want it to evoke Hulkling. It looks the same. Also, Hulkling
like Donnie
is,
Blaze, and Hulkling, who they want us to think Johnny
exactly.
Blaze.
Exactly, and Hulkling is Skrull royalty, so he is technically a Hulk King. I also think, so the reason that we know it is, that another thing that we need to talk about is the way that it pops up, it is very evocative of a website that we just saw, which was called the Intelligentsia, which was kind of this MRA 4chan-esque website where a lot of dudes were just talking about how much they hate She-Hulk and they want to kill She-Hulk. But that in itself is really important because in the comics, the Intelligentsia was this villain knowledge sharing group that ended up becoming a supervillain group, and they were the ones who created Red Hulk, which you find out in 2010's Hulk 23. They were the ones who convinced Thunderbolt Ross to take the Hulk serum and become Red Hulk. So there's also that aspect where it's like,
I think we're heading towards
Red Hulk slash Red She-Hulk for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like, what I think is really interesting is we thought Tim Blake Nelson, the leader, was going to be the one, kind of the Machiavellian guy behind the curtain. He could be. He could see himself
could
as the
be.
Hulk
it
King. But I will also say, he is a really good scientist. He could actually just be running that lab. And whoever is actually behind this, who is the Hulk King, for all we know, I'm going to throw out a really out there one.
Yeah.
What if, like in the comics, so what if Bruce has gone back to Sakaar? Jen cannot get in touch with him, right? Yeah, tinfoil hatting this one, right? What if Scar, Hulk's son, is already on Earth and is the one who is doing all of this because he hates his dad, which is a very canon comic book thing. And he is actually the one who's trying to find out about how Hulk blood works. He's the one who's trying to find out who She-Hulk is. There's all different things that could be coming into play here. And I'm very impressed by how they took what we thought was a pretty simple, but with a lot of fun stuff. Like we had the Elliot Franklin theory. We had a lot of different fun stuff, but I love that now they've turned it on its head and now there's like 100 other people because Intelligentsia has so many Hulk villains in it too. So as well as like MODOK, Red Ghost, Doctor Doom, like all different kinds of people. So there's just so much here that they're playing with. The Hulk King thing just kind of blew my mind because I'm like, I need to know. And also, is it just one of these crazy intelligentsia website guys who just has a ton of money. I know one of the in our Discord, a lot of people have been guessing that the guy who Jen went on a date with, who was like a real creep, who then ended up at the office.
Yeah. Nice.
He might be the villain. And now we know that there's a whole king, super rich, wealthy, like hates strong women, you know. So that would also be really interesting.
Chris, producer Chris, is raising a theory in the chat. Could Josh, cute guy at the wedding, who they eat the fries with in that moment, in that, you know, as the secret camera, wherever that's hidden, like zooms out and we see that she's being observed, Josh is there with her. Could Josh, cute guy at the wedding, end up being a fake out name and he's actually the Hulk King?
I
like that as well.
I think Chris is definitely onto something.
Because they introduced that guy in a way, he can't be just like another nice
guy.
Exactly.
And
you know,
he knows he goes in there with the exact specific attack of, I don't just like She-Hulk, I like Jen, which publicly was just a huge thing in a lawsuit. And then it seems very unlikely to me that he would, he's got her in her Jen form because he likes Jen.
Yeah.
And he, so that means you can get her blood even without an adamantium needle potentially. But adamantium needle is a good choice just because you don't know how someone's human skin could take on its Hulk skin form. But then he's sitting right in the right place in front of the camera so that she can be seen. I think Josh is sadly at least intelligentsia
adjacent.
Adjacent, yeah.
I'll say this. I don't think it's the leader for the following reason. Just put a syringe in your own arm.
Right?
You got the gamma blood.
Is
now,
he trying?
We have established that Jen's blood is super special, even in the context of gamma-irradiated blood. It allowed Bruce to heal his arm. It has different properties. That said, it feels like the leader would be focused elsewhere.
Maybe the leader wants Jen's blood to cure himself because he's like deformed and kind of messed up by it. But also, how would he know that Jen's blood is better blood?
Right, how would he know?
I think with the intelligentsia, the Hulk King, I think that all leads to this idea of somebody creating a Red Hulk or a Red She-Hulk, which we had long wondered about. And I will just say, would be a very cool way to reintroduce Liv Tyler to the MCU. Because Betty is Red She-Hulk in the comics originally. And I just think that would be so cool.
Do you think I agree with the jilted date as being an intelligentsia person, but do you think there's any... You think MODOK or any of the Super Ape or any of the rest are involved in this?
I think they have long talked about bringing MODOK to the MCU. I think he's going to be in the MCU. I don't think this is where. But I do think that knowing She-Hulk, we could see some super weird characters like Awesome Android and like other people who've been in the intelligentsia. Oh, yeah. So Chris just mentioned that. MODOK's confirmed in Quantumania. We've already seen some leaked visuals of what potentially he could look like. But like, I think that knowing She-Hulk, they're going to go for the weird. Now look, MODOK is very weird. I'm not saying that, but MODOK is also
one of the weirdest,
an unbelievably complex character to bring to life.
Yes.
And I think
very
that
much so.
In Quantumania, you probably can dedicate a couple of years to somebody just building MODOK and working out how he would look. You know, if you haven't seen him, he's like basically a giant floating head.
Producer Saul with a extremely tinfoil hat comes with, I wonder if Josh is Amadeus Cho.
I wish that was the case.
I don't think that I like where your head is at. But one, this feels a little bit low stakes for the genius of Amadeus Cho. Mm. And two, I think they probably cast younger seeming.
What if?
A lot younger seeming.
If it was Amadeus Cho, what if, hypothetically, me and Chris are right but wrong? Like, instead of Josh being a part of the intelligentsia, he's actually there to protect Jen.
Oh, I like
because
that.
Because of his super genius. You know, I agree with you, though. I think if you're going to do Amadeus, you're going to probably make him like a super teen. But I do really like that idea. And I don't think it's that out of the realm of possibility simply because we know that this is a place where they're basically introducing slash reintroducing a lot of the Hulk family.
Agreed. And I also, you know, to Chris's point that Monok is confirmed for Quantumania, it feels a little bit like, you know, not to ruin the magic by peeking too far behind the curtain. But I imagine that one, part of the reason they're digging so deep into the crates is because whoever the Marvel lore keeper is at MCU was like, oh, no, you can't use that person because we're using them for this. Can we use MODOK? No, MODOK's in Quantumania, so we can't use them.
Yeah.
Can we use, you know, U.S. agent? No, I can't use U.S. agent.
Yeah, Ziggy, so I mean, Ziggy so even said that's like, you know, he was there to, he was pulling those deep cut places out so you didn't have that crossover for sure.
So I feel like, you know, for all the implications, and there are many, I would imagine that there's a world where Marvel is having similar conversations where they're like, okay, they used this weird character. I wonder what all the implications that we could then generate stories off of from there.
I also think as well, the other thing that we know that the MCU loves to do, I mean, it's part of why we're here with our tinfoil hat theories and our We Were Rights and stuff. They love to seed stuff. So I'm sure that by introducing the intelligentsia, they knew people were going to make that connection to MODOK. And there is a world where we even hear someone referenced, you know, the machine designed only for killing or something. Like I feel like there's a way that they can still have, or they have someone just say, you know, of course, sir, and they send an email and the emails to like MODOK. Like they can do that fun stuff where they seed it in without necessarily having to show like the giant floating head creature, you know? So yeah, this was such a fun episode, but like you said, it's the implications. Like they're having fun, but they're also like vampires exist, Wolverine. Like it's really fun stuff.
Okay, adamantium versus vibranium. Here is my take. And obviously, you know, there's also the possibility that it could be some other weird super, you know, some titanium alloy that they're like, okay, maybe this will, you know, that it's not necessarily adamantium. Although again, clearly they want us to think that. Here's my case for it not being vibranium. While we have established that vibranium is a wonder metal that has a lot of really amazing properties, among them being extreme durability. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we've established with vibranium is that the number one thing about it that really makes it special is that it absorbs and releases kinetic energy. We see that with the Black Panther suit. It's got this property of it can absorb all the damage and all the hits that are being directed towards it, and then it can release it as like a focused energy blast. So it's got that property to it. That is a very distinctly different, like you wouldn't necessarily need that for a needle. What you need for a needle that you want to pierce a Hulk skin is it unbreakable? Yeah. Will it bend? Is it indestructible, basically? And that is the key difference between these two wonder metals is both are really, really, really strong. Vibranium is almost indestructible, but adamantium, unless you bring it to its melting point, is basically indestructible.
Yeah, it's
like you can't break
it. There is obviously times, because it's comic books, where like I believe it was like Ultimate Hulk managed to break an adamantium needle or something. Yeah, but like in general, adamantium's going through whatever they want it to go through. We've seen it with Wolverine. We've seen it.
Yeah.
Also, look. They make these shows. These shows are made by people who love this stuff. They're made by people like Zeb Wells and Zig who make the comics.
Yeah, they know all about this shit.
If you end an episode with a needle that looks really big and shiny and goes into a syringe with a kind of like clink, like snick, they know that people are going to say, oh, that's an adamantium needle. Now, we also know, because of how this show has been and how funny they are and how much they kind of enjoy playing with expectations, it could literally, next week they'll be like, oh yeah, this is a this is a very strong needle called like gadamantium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, they might like do that. Step, that is something that they might
like
do.
It's like the step before adamantium on like yeah. the, but you know, like it's just the reason it's fun is because we get to guess. And also I will say, I think with everything else in this episode, I believe it being adamantium is very, very likely because like I said, they just casually revealed that vampires just fully exist.
Just are fully
they were just
running
like, vampires
around.
Are real. And also yeah. this mutants are real, vampires are real.
Running around.
I think that adamantium in that context could definitely be real and a thing.
Well, let's welcome She-Hulk head writer Jessica Gao to the show now and ask her some questions, potentially including whether or not that's adamantium, and is Mr. Immortal a mutant, and does that mean Krakoa is not a thing right now? Questions I'm sure she will answer.
Definitely going to give us all the answers.
A whole new batch of progressive merch just dropped at the Crooked Store with tees, hats, and bumper stickers that are all about demanding reproductive justice, canceling student debt, and making our democracy work. You can show where you stand even while you sit in traffic. Head to the Crooked Store and pick out something to wear to the voting booth. Or just on your morning coffee run. You guys know how t-shirts work. You can wear them anywhere. Check it out at crooked.com/store.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie lover friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week in the Hive Mind, where we bring on experts to discuss their work and more, X-Ray Vision is thrilled to welcome She-Hulk head writer Jessica Gao.
Woo!
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. So, like, one of the questions we always ask, because this is the bread and butter of what we do and what we care about, like, what's your origin story of comics? Like, how did you find comics? What do you care about? What was it about comics that made you fall in love with them? Or do you not care about comics at all and just ended up on the MCU show?
I was a lifelong comic book reader. When I was a kid, I read mostly manga because I was born in China and I immigrated to America when I was young. And my relatives in China, you know, I was like a bookworm. And so they would always want to send me gifts, you know, because they missed me or because somebody went to visit and you have to send a gift, you know. And they would all, because the one thing they knew about me was that I loved reading, they would constantly send me Chinese bootlegs of whatever was like the hot manga in Japan at the time. And so I just had like stacks of bootleg comics that I read constantly, you know. And so it was a lot of like Dragon Ball and like Ranma and Yu Yu Hakusho, City Hunter, Cat Eye. You know, stuff like that, like whatever was hot in Japan and that the bootleggers felt was worth bootlegging. that's what I got then. And then when I got more into, when I was a teenager, that's when I got into reading like more, you know, like American comics. And like my first job in high school was at the local comic book store.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. But I was never, like, to be fair and honest, I was never huge on mainstream comics. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't read a lot of Marvel or DC. I mostly, like, the most mainstream I read was probably, like, Image and Vertigo comics. Mm-hmm. And then but I really got heavily into, like, the indie stuff, you know? Like, anything that, like, Fantagraphics put out,
yeah.
Slave Labor Graphics, Drawn and Quarterly, like, that was, like, more my jam, you know?
So how did you get attached to She-Hulk? What was the process like? What was your take on the character that got you the gig?
Well, they knew me. I mean, I've told the story a few times now where She-Hulk was the fourth time I pitched at Marvel. So it was the fourth project I pitched there, which means that, you know, I was rejected three times before I got She-Hulk. But She-Hulk was always my favorite character from Marvel Comics. And so all three other times that I got rejected, I would bring up She-Hulk and be like, guys, if you do She-Hulk, you gotta call your girl.
Yeah.
And then I would threaten arson if they didn't, you know, so, just so they knew I was serious.
Yeah.
And And so when I went in to pitch She-Hulk, I mean, anytime I pitch TV, it always starts with character, you know, mm-hmm. like you have to care about this main character to want to hang out with them week after week. And for me, like, you know, what I loved about She-Hulk from the comics was just how meta the burn run was. That was the run that made me fall in love with She-Hulk and her breaking the fourth wall, like how irreverent she was, how funny she was, you know, she didn't take like being in comics too seriously.
Yeah.
Like there was just this levity to it that I really found really refreshing, you know? And so, especially since, you know, like, I think the most mainstream stuff I read when I was a teenager was probably Batman comics. And mm-hmm. that's always very dark and serious, you know? So, like, something like She-Hulk is just, it's so, like, the polar opposite and tone-wise. And I just, it was just like a breath of fresh air. So how I approached the character was, you know, I just felt like, I could really relate to her, you know. I thought about our similarities, you know, we're both women in our 30s with careers, like very focused on work and but also, you know, had friends, had like, you know, family that we talked to, unlike a lot of comic book characters. but then I thought like, you know, if this thing happened to me, if one day there was an accident and I got superpowers and I became a Hulk and there were all these expectations that now I would have to be a superhero, I'd be fucking furious. because if you look at the shirt I'm wearing, it says I'm tired. Yeah. And that's Reliable. How I feel every day. And so I would be like, I'm too tired to add one more thing to my plate. And also, like, I didn't ask for this. Like, no, thank you. You know, like if I was a lawyer and I'd gone through like law school and I'd racked up six figures in student loans, like, who's going to pay that? They're not going to forgive the debt just because I'm a superhero now. Like, I'm still on the hook to pay that off, you know, like, oh, I'm supposed to just like stop everything and, but still have to deal with all the ramifications, like just because it happened. Like I would be, you know what I mean? Like there's, there's so much messiness in the minutia of what happens. Like, yeah, there's the big concept of like, oh, you have powers and now you have to be a superhero. But it's like, but let's look at all the details, you know, like, where are you going to get your health care from? Who's providing that? Yes. Like, how do you get paid? Like, what's your retirement plan if you're a superhero? Yeah. Like, that's all stuff we have to think about.
Yeah, I actually wrote an article after Falcon and the Winter Soldier, the episode where Sam Wilson said that the Avengers didn't get paid and that Tony didn't pay them. And I was like, this has broken my brain. Like the minutia-minded side of my brain is like, how do they live? How do they have insurance? How do they do anything, you know? And so something I'm interested about, because that kind of aspect of minutia and the slice of life aspect of the show is something that we love so much. Do you feel like your love of like indie comics, stuff like you mentioned Fantagraphics, I'm guessing like Love and Rockets, stuff like that, that's like one of my favorite comics. Do you feel like you brought those storytelling sensibilities to She-Hulk as well by kind of looking more at like the holistic life of the character, like indie comics sometimes do, rather than just that big concept superhero stuff?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, I didn't really approach this following a traditional superhero formula, you know? It was definitely more about like, the tone was a lot more important, you know? And like, it's not a plot heavy show. It's an episode. It's a very episodic show. And it's very much about the slice of life, you know? And it really is. It's exactly like you said, it's this like kind of holistic, well-rounded look of like, what is the entire totality of this person's life?
One thing that is really resonating with us as comic book nerds is just how this is the most comic book nerd show from Marvel. It really is. Like the way it just present, you know, the way Mr. Immortal shows up and he's just been around. He's just been around doing his Mr. Immortal thing in the world. And it's taken as part of the texture of this space. And that's part of the excitement of reading comics when I was a kid to me is just having a window open into this entire vibrant world where people are running around doing things, going to the gym, going shopping, using their powers for good and ill. How much of that was really was what you were going for, where you're going to like, we're going to pull from all these different things and we're not even going to be like, how did Mr. Immortal get his powers? Forget about it. We're just going to present him as a person that's running around.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it felt like we're over a decade into the MCU, like, and, you know, every other movie introduces a new character, a new superhero, somebody with powers, you know, and like they're in the double digits now, you know, so people in their world have been living with this for years and years and years. So it's no longer like a shock, you know, to the system of like that people with superpowers exist. These people exist, you know, and not every single person is going to make the news and become an Avenger. There are, you know, people like Mr. Immortal who are like, oh, I'm only going to use this for my personal life. and there's no contribution to society, you know, like there's just people around who have these powers. And, you know, we really wanted to focus on the lower level stuff, not the global save the universe kind of thing. We wanted to focus on like the everyday street level people who aren't making the news and are just kind of existing.
Yeah. And how fun was it as a process to kind of get to go through and pick, you know, we get Mr. Immortal here, we get a reference to Baroness Blood. So I'm like, now definitely that vampires exist in the MCU. That is my headcanon. But like, how fun was it in the room to, you know, we talked to Zig and he was talking about, you know, pulling out names like the Wrecking Crew and stuff. So how fun was it to kind of get to dig in and find those characters who fit this low ground level superhero world that you were building?
It's really fun. And so our writer's room, the makeup of the writer's room was 50% like Marvel super nerds and like Zig and like Zeb Wells and, you know, Jackie Gales and like, and then the other half were just comedy writers who were like, yeah, I have never touched a comic book and I don't really need to unless I'm being paid to do it, you know?
Yeah.
But I like, we needed that balance, you know, because we can't be completely inside baseball when it comes to comics, like, because this is still a sitcom, you know, first and foremost. So it was nice to have that mix of people to kind of balance out, like, what is going to be funny, you know, but what's also going to be true to the comics. And so it was really nice to have half the room be able to like start pulling from the comics, like, you know, like Zig and Zeb and everybody would, they already had like their kind of mental list of characters they've always wanted to see.
Yeah, of course.
And our philosophy was always like the lower level, like the C level, D level, like give us the low rent guys, because then you have the most freedom, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, yeah. You, well, also like A, you have the most like highest probability that it would be available. That no one's like, you know, creating like that Marvel isn't already doing some sort of like trilogy about them. But two, also like you have more freedom because they're not this like precious, revered, like have like a crazy fandom character. They're characters that people are like, oh, I recognize them. That's funny that they're using them, you know? Or characters where they're like, I don't even know where they pulled that from. And, and then you can really like kind of play around with them and come up with like funny stuff for them. So, you know, we pull like characters that we just thought would be funny. And then the whole room would kind of go to work on coming up with like, what's a funny reason they would be in legal trouble? Like what is specific to this character that would require a lawyer? And that's where we went from there. And that's really, really fun to pitch, you know, because at the end of the day, you're just, they're characters, whether or not they're comic characters or sitcom characters, they're just characters that you're coming up with very like character specific stories for.
This seems very obvious to me, but I was wondering if you might spell it out for our audience. It seems, what is it that makes comedy writers like yourself, Jeff Lovnes, Zeb, so the right person to develop and adapt these stories for TV, for film?
I think it's that, well, I think it is, what I loved about Marvel movies was that they're all very, like, even the serious ones, there is the sense of joy, you know, there is the sense of like, of this love for this medium. And like, you know, if you could be very reductive and say like, oh, it's like for kids or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think being able to see the way that like comics have these like strong themes and can tell these like very, like metaphor laden stories, you know, and kind of be a reflection of the times and of people, being able to like take that seriously, but also balance that with like, okay, but it's still, you know, a person with superpowers or some guy who decided to dress up like a frog, you know, like being able to kind of balance that and like treat it like with the right level of seriousness, like, these characters are taking their lives seriously, you know, so we respect that, but we also understand that it's inherently a little silly and lighthearted, you know, and also the stakes on our show are very low. It's not like half of humanity is going to die. It's like, well, is this guy going to have to pay out a settlement, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in that way, actually, it kind of seems wild that there hasn't been like a superhero sitcom. Like, this seems like the perfect balance. So could you talk a little bit about that choice and going, obviously, it makes so much sense for She-Hulk, but why was that? How did you know that was the right pitch?
Well, I come from writing for TV comedies.
Yeah.
So so I was always going to do comedy. I don't write dramas, you know? So it was always going to be a comedy. But I think like She-Hulk of all characters is like so, I mean, the most iconic She-Hulk runs are so like fun and light, you know? And funny. So I think like that's just what's true to the character.
Yeah.
Okay. here we go. We're gonna hit you now with the questions that we're pretty sure you can't answer, but we're gonna try.
Let's see how good my poker face is.
Adamantium needle at the end.
Yes.
Oh!
No, I'm saying yes. Oh, what's your question?
Is it
what's the question?
Yeah, is that an adamantium needle?
No.
Okay. Wow. Oh, interesting. Rosie?
We've not talked about adamantium on the show at all.
There's no talking about it, but you know, guessing.
It's a guess. Here is why we guess that, because of the Hulk's history with adamantium. You know, it's always the only solution to be like, how do we turn the Hulk back into, or get his blood or turn him back into Banner? We got to hit him. What's the only thing that could pierce the skin is an adamantium needle. And it made a very satisfying snick-dish sound, which is why we thought that.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's rare to get a conclusive answer, so I'm very excited about that. Okay, so Baroness Blood, a.k.a. Mr. Immortal's wife.
Potentially.
I mean, so Baroness Cromwell is his ex-wife. Was he married to a vampire? I feel like it would make sense because he's immortal. But was that just like a fun name pull?
That was just a fun name pull. We don't know who this person is that he was married to.
Okay. Obviously, you've had a lot of fun over this season with like names that are one letter off from names that we recognize. Donnie Blaze. Donnie Blaze, for instance, is a fantastic
iconic.
And then at the end of this episode, you know, when we see that secret lab where they're working to collect Jen's blood, we see a chat on a screen, a computer message from someone named Hulk King, which seems like very specifically one letter off from Hulkling. is that another Donnie Blaze, Johnny Blaze, Hulk King, Hulkling? Is that another one of those Donnie Blaze situations?
What I will say is you have to think about the world of the show as this is a world where people are aware of all these kind of superheroes, beings, villains, aliens. Everyone's aware that these types of people exist, you know? So you have to think like there are people in this world who are like our world. Fans, you know, people who are into like fan fiction, people who are modeling themselves after these people, you know, people who know like the name Hulk and are, you know, coming up with just a screen name that is a reflection of what they're interested in and who they're interested in.
Okay, and this is less of a spoiler question, but links to the Hulk King moment. Could you talk a little bit about introducing the intelligentsia as this kind of like MRA website and how that plays into how well you guys kind of preemptively joked about what you knew the response to the show would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just, we had our writer's room in 2019. That's how long ago we started writing this show. So, I mean, it truly preempts a lot of the stuff because we knew. I mean, I think it just goes to show how completely unoriginal and tired and boring
these
guys are, you know, that 3 years ago we could predict like exactly what they were going to say. Like, fucking get a new song, man. And it's just, I mean, it's funny, but it's also sad that like it's so accurate. And also that it is so common and so predictable we could this accurately like just pull it out, you know, because it is specific to the show, but it also isn't like that type of like hate and like stupidity is not specific to this show only, you know, it's so prevalent that that's why we were able to just know exactly, you know. So it was very funny when the show premiered, seeing all the responses where I was like, you just wait till the third episode comes out. Because the little troll inside of me was also giggling. Like,
trolling the trolls, baby.
Well, Jessica, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was great.
Yeah, it was such a joy. Thank you.
Folks, we're stepping out of the airlock onto the streets of Ferrix. Beautiful company town, Ferrix. For the first three episodes of Andor, written by Tony Gilroy, directed by Toby Haynes. Again, we just want to touch on this these episodes because we want to give everybody time to process them and to really digest them. And then we're going to be talking about it regularly as the series progresses. But first off, Rosie, what are your thoughts?
So I thought it's very beautiful. I'm happy to, I'd love to see Diego back. You know, we're big fans of Rogue One on this show.
Huge fans. Huge fans of Rogue One.
So yeah, I love the landscape. I love that it's not a nostalgia-fueled show. I think, like, we've all talked about this. People in the Discord have been talking about this. This is a show that is almost has a similarity to Lord of the Rings in that the first episode may be a little bit homework heavy, a little bit introductory yes. heavy, but you get those three episodes. So by the end, you've really kind of dived in. So yeah, I thought it's like a good show. I'm a big fan of Tony Gilroy, who they bring in to save everything. So I'm really happy to see him getting to have this space to do this. I do have some moments that like bumped me though. So that's I'm excited absolutely. To talk to you about it.
So I too, I think it looks absolutely like jaw-dropping stunning, actually. Yeah. Like the volume is doing incredible work. Clearly, I think they shot on location somewhere. It looks amazing. Rogue One is probably my favorite Star Wars movie. And I think the vibe of Rogue One, which kind of recontextualized the part of the impact of the original Star Wars as a flipped allegory to the Vietnam War, you know, in which, scrappy rebels take on this superpower with weapons of mass destruction and actually defeat it. Rogue One took that and brought it into the 21st century with an allegory that essentially says that acknowledged the power of the kind of like freedom fighter narrative. You had these rebels fighting to defend a holy city with rare natural resources that were being exploited by a superpower. You know, it's like this, it's the grievances of the Middle East with regards to the United States as empire, but mixed up and put back, and digested back and given back to us as a Star Wars story. I think that was part of like what really gave it its power. And I think Andor is similarly continuing to do that same thing, which is taking really, really provocative ideas and saying, okay, at what level does violent resistance to corporate power become mm-hmm. morally acceptable? At what point does violent resistance to the security state become, while clearly illegal, morally acceptable? At what point does the destruction of the environment warrant a morally, potentially violent response? And those ideas are really, really, really just very, very interesting and kind of like radical to explore in
especially
the context
right
of Star
now.
Wars. Right now, and I think that part of it has me absolutely hooked. Here is where is the thing that bumps me as well. I do bump on certain things. One, and this is all with the caveat that we need more context and I need to see where this is going.
You know, Andor is 12 episodes long, yes. So we're literally a quarter of the way through the show. There is a lot that we can still discover, but we both definitely got caught on a couple of the same things.
The kind of, like, reframing of a story about indigenous people fighting against a technological colonial foe made me feel a little bit weird, that being Diego's backstory. Just not weird in that the idea of doing it, but the way they presented it makes me maybe a tad uneasy if I don't know where it's going. At this point, I'm like, it's definitely something I'm like, I wonder where this is going, because this is either, like, again, another super, super radical theme and detail in the context of a Star Wars show, or maybe a little bit of a miss.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like I love to see, we're living in an age right now where there's finally, we're getting a lot of really brilliant, like, indigenous storytelling in a mainstream accessible space. The storytelling's always been there, but now it's getting a platform, whether it's like, you know, Reservation Dogs, Blood Quantum, like one of my favorite movies from the last few years. There's a lot of great stuff being made. Saying that, I too wonder, I love the notion of exploring an indigenous culture in Star Wars. That's incredible. Yeah. It fits in with the radical.
I love that, yeah.
Me too. I personally, my first feeling about it was like, this could have been the prequel to just see, so we could have spent time there and got to know them. And it wasn't so much of just kind of flashback to trauma, which is a lot of what we're getting right now. So I'm interested in that. You know what? I feel like in a post-Wakandan world, let's say, I think that fantasy and sci-fi and ideas of indigenous populations in sci-fi and fantasy, I feel like I want to see where they're going with this idea of like nature versus technology, because I feel like in the Star Wars world, that indigenous culture could have been like a very highly, it could have been represented differently in a way that embraces both nature and sci-fi that would have felt maybe a little bit less simplistic.
Really, the main thing for me is the decision to not have us understand what they are saying.
Yes, that's felt, the biggest.
It felt like an unnecessary othering for lack of a better, more subtle phrase, of a people that doesn't really occur in Star Wars usually. Usually no. It's like, especially if this is like the main character, you want us to empathize and understand what a particular ethnicity or a people or a race or an alien group or androids are saying. And you want to, and I guess you could say, well, they don't subtitle the droids.
But
fine.
People translate what they're saying by telling you what they're saying.
They translate it right back.
I will also say it's very different than, say, I remember, when West Side Story came out, the Steven Spielberg one, there's a lot of unsubtitled Spanish in that. And I thought that that's actually really interesting and cool, because you're basically allowing Spanish speakers to experience part of the film that non-Spanish speakers can't. And it that is an interesting subversion of how English speaking is usually non-subtitled. But this is I just double checked because I wanted to be sure, but this is a made up language. It's Canary. Yeah. So I don't in that way understand why they
now,
don't
again,
subtitle.
I want to see where it's going.
Yes.
And then the other thing, because again, I think the idea, again, as you said, presenting an indigenous people through the lens of Star Wars and exploring their culture, I think there's nothing inherently weird or wrong about that. In fact, that's fascinating and an idea I'd love to dive into. I also think it's really fascinating and radical to explore the idea of what an indigenous people could do to defend themselves that would be morally right, considering the encroachment on their spaces, which is clearly an idea that this show is exploring when young Andor comes to the edge of that great mining pit and sees what's being done to his planet. There's an anger and a defiance that flashes in his eyes, and it's the same anger and defiance that flashes in his eyes as an older man throughout the episodes that we see. And I think it draws a through line there of this idea of how much and he says, you know, no one would expect a person like me to be the one who gets, you know, paraphrasing now the thing he says in the trailer and other places. But I think that there's that through line there of how much does a people have to put up with before it's okay for them to fight back. And I think that's clearly an idea that this show is presenting, and it's a really interesting idea. That said,
okay, I just want to jump on that just quickly.
Yeah, no,
because I know the next
thing.
So the only thing, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I just, the other thing that kind of gets to me a little bit about it, is like, I love that because I love radical ideas of struggle. The sad thing is in this case is like, wouldn't it have been, I know it doesn't work because we have to have Aunt Cassie and have some kind of loss, but like, couldn't we imagine a world where an indigenous people fought back and like won? Because it's a utopian Star Wars style space where you're imagining it. Also, like the other thing that I find interesting in the context, and like we said, I'm very interested to see where it goes because this could all be very intentional and be kind of expanded on or explored or excavated as we go through. But also, like, you know who never worried at any point about whether killing people was right in Star Wars? Like, every white person who's ever in Star Wars who just blows stuff up and kills people and is seen as a hero. So I just, I wonder, I want to see that moral. I want to know why the moral weight is so heavy on Cassian, because the things that he is fighting against are arguably so much more obviously deserving of rebellion or revolution. Mm-hmm. But
that's
again, that could definitely be something that we see expanded on as the show goes forward. There are a lot of points here where if these moments that we're talking about and are about to talk about another one are intentional and get explored and extrapolated on, and that could be a really, really radical space in the Star Wars universe. Or like, you know, you were saying, if not, then it could be, there's a chance that it could end up being like a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yeah. And so I think the thing that bumped me really the hardest is at the end of the, and again, this could be really interesting, and I'm holding out, I can't wait to see more to see how this, you know, reframes the context, potentially. Marva, who, you know, has followed this ship that crashed on Kinari, is scavenging whatever kind of tech and different stuff that they have, and they want to get out before the Republic answers. And they come across this young indigenous person who is Cassian Andor, young Cassian Andor. Doesn't have that name yet, of course. And they're concerned that, you know, the Republic's going to show up and everybody's going to be potentially facing, you know, real danger that could end up with the extinction of this tribe, I guess, is their concern. And so Marva kidnaps, you know, like, let's just say what it is, kidnaps Cassian and takes him away on her spaceship. And so my question is this, are we framing that as this like unambiguously good rescue, or is there necessary ambiguity to this action? Because while I don't doubt that Marva thinks I'm saving this young man's life, what is functionally happening is you are kidnapping him, taking him away from his tribe, from his people, from his culture, from his entire world, because you're concerned that he's in danger, and that may or may not be true, but also, like, that's not your role.
Yeah, and the way that you just
that's not your responsibility.
I think it's very clear, fingers crossed, that seems to be even just in the way you frame it, the way you speak about it, it seems like the right route to go is to use that as an analogous conversation about the times that has happened in real life, the
right.
kidnapping of indigenous children, of children from the global community, the global majority, and seeing and having that as like, we're doing something good. And then we know that that is obviously historically something that has become very horrific and just a way of exploiting children and harming children. So it feels to me like, I don't think Star Wars is going to be like, oh, Marva is, you know, an evil person. But I do think there could definitely be, there should be a depth and a conversation between Marva and between Cassian about the realities of what she did and how that shifted the scope of his life and the way that his life turned out.
Yeah, because it's definitely, you know, again, he may very well be in danger. You know, we're seeing a side through their eyes, through Marva's eyes, of the Republic that is, you know, less good than we're probably used to. And certainly more exploitive of cultures and planets than aren't technologically advanced or part of the Republic writ large. But again, she just like snatches him up without any kind of,
doesn't even check.
Would this be okay?
Yeah.
Who are your people? Do you have family here? Who's your family here? And kidnaps him from what is essentially a utopian planet. That, I mean, this is another trope. This is an age old trope, right? Of the, of the people who are less technologically advanced live in this more egalitarian, just perfect society.
Yeah, like the peaceful. And I that's another thing where I wonder if there was a techno jungle twist or some kind of exploration that could have maybe potentially or might still happen. We've only seen certain parts.
This is the thing.
It's been in flashbacks, so we might learn that there is more to it. But like you said, that segment to me definitely had the feeling of that age-old trope. It didn't necessarily feel like it was adding anything to... Because let's be real. I saw... like a lot of people have said this, but like how many indigenous cultures have we seen been destroyed in Star Wars? So many. Like
so is many. That many. It's not the first one. Yeah.
It's not the first one. And it's like
R.I.P. to the Ewoks.
So like is that necessarily like a new story that needs to be told in the Star Wars universe? Hopefully, as Cassian, because this is a very slow burn show as well. So hopefully as it moves forward, we're gonna get to see that conversation changed. But I would like to know about not subtitling the Canary. The more I think about it, the more I'm like, is that going to change? Is that, I think on the, on our version, there was no captions, but I think on the final version, it says speaking Canary.
Here's the other thing that I think makes it an interesting choice to me. These are flashbacks through, how are we getting here, right? We're getting, the presentation is these are Cassian's reminiscences. Mm. And by choice, they are not allowing us that perspective that he has where he understands what these people are saying. They're not letting us in there. So even, you know, from that perspective of a storytelling choice of a flashback from the perspective of a character, it's a little puzzling to me.
That's a really great point.
People might listen to this conversation and be like, they didn't like it. I actually loved it. Like, And the fact that we are able to have these really like, these are big conversations about big ideas through the context of Star Wars is why I like Rogue One, why I think this is certainly the most interesting to discuss right now in terms of like ideas and themes and ideas about morality and ideas about like, you know, about struggle, period. Having those conversations through this show, it is really fascinating because, again, this is a show that is straight up like, okay, if it presents this idea to you and says that this is acceptable, if the powers of policing fuse with corporate interest.
Sounds familiar.
It is okay to resist that violently. That's a kind of radical idea to put forward. Yeah. And it's putting it forward in the context of a Star Wars show. And I think that's like pretty amazing.
Yeah. And also as well, I think that something that you bring up that's really great there is how this carries on the tradition of Star Wars as like a radical analogy in Star Wars. Like, look, we know what the Empire is based on in Star Wars. It's based on Nazis. It's a response to fascistic dictatorships that are not afraid to kill and exploit. And the story there was, you need to stand up against those. Those must be stopped. And it doesn't matter if there's only one of you who is standing up. You can make a difference because you will find other people. So now, you know, that movie came out in the late 70s, the original Star Wars. Like now in 2022, to have a show that's like, by the way, if the police...
Resist the Nazis.
Yeah. And also saying like, we're going to make it more specific. If the police and evil corporations are destroying your life and your livelihood and your towns, it's actually okay to not be okay with that and to want to resist it. That is a very cool reconsideration and updating and making the message far more specific than just like the generic bad guy.
And I love... I mean, there's a real class struggle aspect to this, too. Like the fact that we don't have royalty, galactic royalty, lords, you know, Sith lords like running around making the choices. This is the people who are closer to the Earth who are working. The way, you know, Luthen and Cassian have that conversation, you know, when they're meeting for the first time, potentially going to have the handoff of the device of the navigation system, and they kind of in a roundabout way start talking about the Empire, and Luthen's like, yeah, they're arrogant, aren't they? Like they don't understand how mad we are at them.
Yeah,
they're fat and happy, and they're just using their power to push everyone around. Like they don't understand like what they're doing. They don't understand the anger they're engendering. That was that's an amazing thing to watch happen, to watch this like rebellion start to coalesce, not at the highest levels, but the grassroots anger at the Empire that actually the leadership then harnessed order to fight their war.
It's what makes Rogue One so special is you literally watch a group of marginalized people, predominantly people of color, die in order to spark the rebellion in a very literal sense where they need, without them, you would never have the blueprints that allowed the rest of the Star Wars franchise to happen. So everybody dies. All these people of color die. These people from all over the planet, from all different places, all over the galaxy. And then at the end, Princess Leia, a space royal, has the blueprints. You know, that's what's so radical about Rogue One is like, who dies so that the people in charge can fight the war and win the war, right? And that's what I think is very interesting with Cassian is like, we're coming at it from this viewpoint of like, we want this to be the best version of this story that makes the most of the space that it's created. Because Rogue One really was this really radical space. And it's very interesting to see that explored here, especially the notion of a corporate town, you know, something, a business town, which is something that, you know, we see in our, again, it's very relevant in 2022.
There's also, I mean, they gave Cassian a real kind of like Han Solo when he shoots those two PM employees. There's a look that flashes across his face, and it's definitely not regret that he just killed two people. It's, fuck, now I got to deal with this.
Yeah.
You know? And that is I love that they gave him that kind of characteristic. Like, that's the kind of character we're dealing with.
Yeah.
You know, Han Solo pulled the trigger on Greedo.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Never thought about it again.
Also, yeah, he just did that because he owed him some money too. Like it wasn't even a matter of survival. Yeah, so something I found really interesting as well, like in that context, like the one thing that really hooked me was they do that great thing as so many storytellers do where there's a moment that everything hinges on. And in this, it is the PM... you know, the kind of head of PM, there's a young guy, Cyril Khan. Again, I'll be interested to see where they go with that. I feel like he was queer-coded and he is a villain. So, you know, we'll see where that leads. But what I found was really interesting is his boss, who is obviously corrupt and is in this, he was just like, just let it go, man. They weren't meant to be there. They got in the wrong fight with the wrong person. And I was like, wow, that I just thought that was such an interesting moment where there's a different version of this story where they never look for Cassie and it never leads down that way. And but there's this one villainous guy who, for some reason that we're still kind of waiting to find out, has this fervent hatred of what happens and needs to solve the crime, you know, and I'm interested to see where that goes. But I really thought that was one of the most interesting choices, was when the kind of corrupt boss of PM was, or the security kind of corpos was like, you know what? They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like, sorry to those men. Like, they shouldn't. I thought that was a really interesting character point that feels much, again, much more grounded in reality than this idea of the well put together empire who will take down anyone who dares to question them. This is real people in the beginnings of what kind of working in the groundwork, this depressing grunt work of this kind of fascistic empire. It's very interesting.
Yeah, this is a show that I'm super excited about continuing to talk about, because the ideas here are just so, so huge. Big thank you to Jessica Gao for joining us. And of course, a big thank you to Ferozi Knight for co-hosting X-Ray Vision today. Rosy, more plugs. What have you to plug?
You can find me, Rosy Marks, on Instagram and Letterboxd. That's also in the show notes. You can also find my articles and stuff like that in the show notes. I will hopefully have some more exciting comic book news coming soon. And obviously, you can always hear me here with you.
Catch the next episode on September 30th and subscribe to the show on YouTube. Please follow us on @XRVPod on Twitter. And don't forget, in the show notes is our link to the Discord. Check out the Discord. Come hang out with us. Come hang out with the community. Lots of friendly, generous, and really smart people there. Rosy and I are active there all the time. Don't forget, send your House of the Dragon questions to askthemaester@gmail.com. And if you want to hear our full conversation this week on House of the Dragon and Rings of Power, check out the first episode. Should be in your feed, which we have already released. If you're listening to this one, that one is out as well. We want your 5-star reviews. Give us those 5-star ratings on your podcast platform of choice. Here's a great one from Smirtalek. Jason Concepcion and Rosy Knight are crushing it. Love the energy this podcast gives. Super fun commentary on the industry and unique insights and fantastic reviews, reactions on the latest nerd culture shows and movies. Thank you so much, Smirtalek.
Thank you. How nice.
Thank you. X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin. The show is executive produced by myself and Sandy Gerard. Our editing and sound design is by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Dylan Villanueva and Matt DeGroote provide video production support. Alex Relaford handles social media. Thank you, Brian Vasquez, for our theme music. See you next time, everybody.
Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways you probably haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Questlove, and Cate Blanchett. In recent weeks, I talked to actor Dan Levy, director Ava DuVernay, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.